Good day. We hope that you enjoyed today's repeat episode of Crush It with CJ the DJ on CFRC 101.9 FM.
G'day and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's and at other Ontario universities. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you know you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. But today, though, I'd like to introduce you to Janelle Regnier-Davies from Toronto Metropolitan University, or TMU for short, who is doing a PhD in Environmental Applied Science and Management under the supervision of Dr. Sarah Edge. Welcome to Grad Chat, Janelle.
Thanks for having me, Colette.
So we've got another one. Yes, I know a few weeks ago I talked to another student that was actually from Wilfrid Laurier, Debbie, who was at the late shift, which is where I got to meet these wonderful students. And Janelle was another one, this time from TMU. So Janelle, what did you think about the late shift?
Oh, it was amazing. I just emailed the director of my program yesterday saying how it was so nice to have a chance to just kind of ignore the rest of the world for a little bit and focus on my work. And also, I guess, because I started my dissertation during the pandemic, I've been very isolated in my work, working, mm-hmm. Even though I'm a community-based researcher, I've been working out of my home and my bedroom and my kitchen, which I'm where I am now, and I haven't had a chance to be very connected with other PhD students. So it was really nice to get talking to other people and connect over similar challenges and also exciting opportunities. And it was just really nice to meet a range of people doing so much interesting work in Southern Ontario. Like, it was just great. Yeah.
And that's why I love it. I mean, our listeners have heard it year after year, how the Lake Shift Riding Retreat is one of my favorite events to be a part of, because it is exciting to hear all the different research that is going on and listen to the different conversations and, you know, cross-disciplinary, cross-university. Mm-hmm. It's brilliant. And mm-hmm. I hope all our students come away feeling rejuvenated, both mm-hmm. in body and in mind, because I certainly do when I go home.
But mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's great that you were able to join us.
I saw some friends the next day and they said, you are a new woman, because I had been very stressed and anxious before I went. So it was really needed, actually. It was great.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting too, because you said you started this journey during the pandemic, which is not easy. An easy place to start. I mean, we all know doing a PhD can be a lonely experience, but even more so during that period of time. How are you finding it now that we're outside of that?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm still working in isolation. I live in Hamilton. I'm not very connected with my community at TMU as much as I'd like to be. Mm-hmm. That being said, I've gained a lot of connection through the research community at TMU more than my own program. So I'm part of the Center for Studies in Food Security, and it's been what I've considered to be like my home base and where people are with like-minded research, and also found a lot of mentorship and guidance and opportunity within that space. But yeah, the pandemic, it's funny because I know for so many people it had been a time where a lot of trauma and hardship has happened. I think for me and my family, it was a good time to reset because I had lost touch with what was important, and I was working a lot and I was very career focused and I didn't have a lot of time for my children, and I've rearranged my life to be more present for them and home centric. So it was a blessing in disguise, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think it's great too. I mean, I totally agreed. It was a time for us all to sit back and reflect on mm-hmm. What are our priorities are important in our lives today, mm-hmm. Which was great. But I also like the fact that you said even though you're living in Hamilton, you've managed to find a way to make connections at the university. particularly in a topic that is clearly of interest to you, which comes to the research. I mean, that was a segue into your research topic. And so, Janelle, your research topic for everyone is food security and food insecurity responses on the municipal level. So I guess, firstly, you know, what is your background anyway? Because you were working, you've come back to do some study. So what is your background and what made you want to get into that?
Yeah, I always have a hard time talking about my research without talking about how I came into it. So pre-pandemic, I was a project manager at a pretty large food diversion organization called Second Harvest. Right. And a food diversion is when you work with a bunch of partners and making sure that food doesn't get wasted. So they work with a range of industry partners, but also many hundreds of community-based organizations that are running food programming. And that is quite diverse. It's food banks, meal programs, after-school programs, senior programs. It's quite diverse. It's not just food banks, which I think a lot of people assume. Mm-hmm. And when the pandemic happened, I was part of the program's team that was asked to be part of the emergency operations unit within the city of Toronto. And they were also asked to be part of a national food response team with the federal government. Being part of the program's team meant that I did sit on the table with a bunch of colleagues that were working in this space and collaborated with the city of Toronto in making sure that there was an adequate response to the heightened food insecurity that happened in the first phases of the pandemic, and that is still occurring, to be honest. It hasn't. Mm-hmm. We aren't out of it yet. We're still there. And for me at the time, I was in a tiny condo in Toronto without childcare. I was having meetings in the hallway of the condo where I wasn't supposed to be. A kid couldn't go on the playground because it was all roped off because of whatever concerns public health had about playgrounds being a source of contamination. I'm not sure why. It was really hard. So I wasn't able to keep that position. And I had a team of really great colleagues that kind of took the lead with that. And the same week of that pandemic, I got my acceptance letter to go to TMU for my PhD.
Oh, that was fortuitous.
There was a lot of kind of...
The stars aligned.
Yes,
in one way.
There was a lot of big decisions that had to happen that week. And deciding to pursue academia was an opportunity to take a beat, mm-hmm. pull back a little bit from the community work. But also, it was really important to me to keep my foot in the community. And if I'm going to go into academia, it has to be community-centered research.
Right.
So my supervisor and I, at the time, developed a proposal for SHRC. There was a special COVID grant. And we applied in partnership with the City of Toronto to kind of assess the emergency response. But we are looking at the community organizations and rather than the impact on residents. So some people think that's a little bit confusing, but because there were 400 organizations responding to the crisis in at first a very uncoordinated way, they developed some systems of coordination and wanted to have some means of capturing what that looked like and what were some of the assets that made it work, what were some of the vulnerabilities, and that's what my team did. So I was hired as a HQP, a highly qualified personnel.
Sounds good.
Yes, yeah.
Put that after your name.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's just in lieu of I couldn't be like the principal investigator because I wasn't yet an academic faculty member in the eyes of SHRC. So I couldn't be that person. I had to be an HQP, and Sarah was the PI. And we developed a team and we interviewed there was around 30 organizations that we interviewed. About a dozen of the municipal staff that were kind of pivotal in the food security response. And through that work, there was a very applied research framework there where we ended up with a kind of a report and we did a knowledge mobilization event at the end of that research. So I actually, as a PhD student, typically you would start doing your research in your second or third year, second year after you write your proposal and you defend your comps and all that. But I jumped in doing my proposal writing in the summer before I started my program, like in the heat of in the moment, and then submitted that proposal with Sarah. She did a lot of the heavy lifting at that point, and then hit the ground running, starting research in January of, was that 2021? So it was still when, I'm not sure it was still like considered like first wave, but we were able to reflect on what happened in that first wave.
Right.
And capture what the strengths were within the city and within the community, and to look at vulnerabilities and where they can strengthen in the likelihood of some other sort of crisis. And we can see too that there was a lot of research on climate crisis vulnerabilities in the city, but nothing really about this sort of crisis before.
It's so interesting. You just talked then about you were able to sort of capture what was going on in the first wave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you had the report. Were you able to also capture, maybe it's outside the scope, the second wave and anything that got learned from the first that got changed for the second?
That's a good question. So, I mean, it wasn't divided in waves because we were going through the research when obviously those timelines overlapped. Mm-hmm. And we were doing interviews over like a 6 to 8 month period.
Right.
So I think we didn't have a very clear timeline, even knowing that there was waves at the time. We didn't really have that kind of bird's eye view of what the pandemic would look like. So not entirely, but what happened with that first, I would say, phase of research when we interviewed the community organizations and the municipality, one of the big things that came out of those conversations was a real positive collaboration that happened between different organizations across the city and with the city, as well as funders. So a big piece of that was how flexible, when in crisis, money can flow. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, during this time, there was the murder of George Floyd and the mobilization of the Black Lives Movement. A lot of attention brought towards the 215 unmarked graves in Kamloops.
Right.
And a resurgence and attention to Indigenous reconciliation. So these kind of overlapping social tensions were pushing the range of actors to think a little bit more critically of the work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And to be more mindful about supporting and directing resources where it's needed most. And a result of that is a lot of community organizations, especially those that are like housed within and led by Black communities or newcomer communities or Indigenous communities, there was a suddenly like money flowing in ways that hadn't before. Okay. And a lot of those barriers being kind of reduced during that time. And so that kind of moved into my second phase of research, was looking at what were funders doing to change their practices to be more inclusive and thoughtful and critical and supportive of different groups of people without being performative. And so,
right,
because
that's easy to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, to be honest, I think a lot of the things that people were doing were out of crisis and out of like not having a lot of time to even manage and have oversight over funds and just kind of letting money flow. But that shift in how people were dealing with resources was really incredibly beneficial to organizations, because suddenly they had less reporting requirements. Application processes for getting funds to serve their communities was reduced. A lot of organizations, especially those leading within like Black communities or those leading in like communities that are densely populated with immigrant populations, they don't have time to be competing for funds. And no. Often they struggle to do the important work that they have to do while also looking for resources to keep that work going. So they saw a lot of benefits of just like the reduction of barriers to funds, and we're able to also have more conversations about broader policy change that's needed to make mm-hmm. sure that equity and access continues and isn't a performative act.
Is the, because you talk about equities and you know, EDI pr- practices mm-hmm. and things, which is super, super important. And as you mentioned too, during the pandemic, because we were at a point of crisis, some of the red, I call it red tape, yeah. went out the door, you know, because right. we don't have yeah. months to make a decision. We need to make it now because yeah. people are going to be hungry mm-hmm. or whatever is being put out there. Mm-hmm. But were you able to show so far with some of your reporting that, you know, this service can still work without all the red tape?
Exactly.
And as long yeah. as we still have to be fiscally responsible because we've got to be able to continue it.
Yeah.
But we don't always need the red tape and we've proven it.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's something that I've captured a little bit in my second manuscript, which just got gone through the publication process.
Good job.
This week, which I don't, it's not available yet, but it's in the Journal of Food, Culture and Society, which is a right. British-based journal.
Fantastic.
I'm excited about. And I wrote about those changes and how we can continue working in that space without the looming crisis over our heads and to mm-hmm. keep on practicing equitable distribution of resources. But in reality, I think a lot of funders have kind of gone back to older kind of top-down approaches, despite this kind of rhetoric of trust-based funding being quite popular in the sector. Mm-hmm. I'm not in funding. I have like kind of periphery experiences being somebody who's applied for money many times, but don't know exactly how decision making happens on their end. But what I do see is that a number of funders and philanthropists and foundations, even municipal government funding programs, have done a lot to kind of change internal practices to be less restrictive and to be more thoughtful about equitable distribution and to reduce those barriers to groups of people that had historically been kept out of the resource pool, basically. And a lot of that has to do with organizations being so small that they don't have maybe charitable status, but then they have to work with a trustee. And there's a whole range of problems with that kind of structure within yeah. the funding landscape. Yeah, sorry.
So clearly there's a lot of different groups involved in helping community-based food security. Mm-hmm. So from various levels of government to philanthropic organizations to mm-hmm. Joe Blow down the road to right. the food bank, you know, yeah. Second Harvest, those sorts of groups, mm-hmm. lots of different levels. Is there a way that you would like to create some sort of model to show, well, you know, because we do have to be accountable.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we also need to be responsive to what's going on in our communities. Mm-hmm. So is there a way of figuring out, okay, so various government levels, we need to perhaps do this process a little bit more because it's taxpayers' money, blah, blah, blah. But then other yeah. groups could do this, another, and then the groups like the food banks and Second Harvest and those other sorts of groups have a bit more freedom mm-hmm. or whatever. But we still need to get food and money to them to be able to distribute. So
yeah.
this clearly has to be a flow, but there needs to be different levels perhaps to get the process there quicker.
Right. So I think before we talk about community level resource distribution, which mm-hmm. is a big part of what my research is on, I do want to bring attention to the fact that these organizations are doing this work because of a failure of the system.
Right.
So there is a lack of social policy, or there's gaps in social policy that create the situation where people are food insecure in the first place mm-hmm. that need to access particular types of programs like food banks. And I will say that there is a range of programs that are available that aren't food banks that are really important, that even if you are food secure, you can access and should access, and they're really important for the community. But for those that are really centered on food insecurity, they are overwhelmed. They're spread thin. They don't never have enough resources. Even if they get all the resources that are available to them,
yeah.
there's always a need that's beyond their capacity. And this is a problem. What we need to do to kind of lessen the burden on the community level response is to make sure that, and this might be provincially, it could be having proper minimum wage standards or even people are exploring universal basic income. This is something that a lot of advocates are pushing for, making sure that there's some sort of security in housing, because there's a terrible housing crisis, not just in Canada, but internationally. These are things that need to come from upper levels of government to make sure that we aren't overburdened with these crises on the ground level in communities, in municipalities. So the municipal government can do a lot to address food system issues, but they can't be the only, it can't be the only place that's addressing these issues. There's provincial responsibility, there's federal responsibility, and at the municipal level, the best thing that municipal departments can do is support those that are doing the work on the ground, and also be flexible with things like zoning, be flexible with things like funding. There's a whole range of like policy things within the municipality that they can do to support food systems and food security, but ultimately we need federal level and provincial level policy change.
We need to stop it before it gets to that situation.
Exactly.
And I mean, that's a last stop gap, but it's not really a solution per se.
Yeah, it's funny because everybody in this community always says that food banks and food programs or other kind of community-based programs are band-aid solutions. And I had heard one food bank director say it's not a band-aid, it's a tourniquet. And like I think that's more accurate. It's trying to stop people from dying. So these spaces are not band-aids. They're much needed tourniquets to prevent people from completely falling through the cracks.
Cracks. Mm-hmm. You know, I almost wish sometimes, and maybe they still do, but I know when I was growing up, there was always, in primary school, we always had lunchtime, a hot meal was given to everybody. And if you could afford it, you paid 12p. Mm-hmm. And if you couldn't, you got it for free. So that was to ensure every child went home and had at least one good hot meal a day.
Right. Yeah.
I wish they would bring things like that back.
You know what they are, actually? There's a really great team called the Coalition for Student Nutrition. They are connected with TMU. They're connected with the Canadian Association for Food Studies. They've been advocating for a universal student nutrition program across Canada for years. And in February, there was an announcement from the federal government that they were going to support and plan and develop and launch a universal student nutrition program. So that's really important. But I also think that some people would say that this isn't addressing the problem still. Right?
Well, that's true. Yes, that's true. Because this is a problem now that the parents haven't been able to afford to give them a decent meal. So why can't the parents afford it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So even with amazing things like student nutrition programs, which is important, and even if you're not food insecure, I still think it's really important because there's a lot of socialization around food that we see in daycares. And then as soon as students go to school in elementary school, a lot of that socialization around food is gone. So,
So what else are you trying to highlight in your research? Because we can do some research and that's great, but for something in particular like this, is it bringing some recommendations? Is it just making people more aware? Is it showing the government, you know, we can solve this if you do this?
Yeah, so I think my research has two parts. There's a kind of applied research component, and there's more of a academic or theoretical contribution that I'm working on. I think for the applied piece, there was a lot of that kind of front-end crisis planning and future crisis prevention planning. That there's a 60-page report that we published that's available on the website of the Center for Studies in Food Security. That was one component. A second component is I'm currently working with a couple community leaders to develop guidelines for funders on equitable practices, making sure that they're walking the talk or talking the walk or whatever however you'd frame that, and also not co-opting language of community, which we do see happening, especially when community organizations are talking about Black sovereignty or Indigenous reconciliation or food justice. They're using that language that is community language, not funder language. And those things shouldn't be co-opted. So we're working on a report that's guidelines around that for funders. And so that could be folks that are working in philanthropy or working in foundations or even government levels where there's granting programs. Right. This kind of report is important for them. So on the more theoretical or academic side of things, these conversations about food insecurity and what needs to be done, I think my contribution is really highlighting the importance of not just including community voices into policy discussions, but also just taking the lead, mm-hmm. letting community take the lead. And we see that this is really happening with the Black Food Sovereignty Movement in Toronto, a group of really hardworking individuals that have been supporting Black food security for 25, 30 years. It was because the city really started to see that, yeah, there was communities that were not accessing funding, that were completely right. left out of the conversation because of their organizational structures. And so started working with them a little bit more and the Confronting Anti-Black Racism Unit to develop a Black food sovereignty plan that was adopted into the city council. So we see really good examples of this happening within the Black community, and we see right. some examples of this happening within the Indigenous Prosperity Plan with the city. But there's also newcomer communities that should be mm-hmm. also being listened to and leading municipal policy and making sure that they have an influence on priorities. So that's one piece of it.
So what's next for you, Janelle? I mean, because you clearly come from this background, you know, from what you described that you were working in. Now you've taken a sidestep to sort of all those things that you were seeing going on, et cetera. You've had a chance to get into the academic side of it mm-hmm. to be able to put a voice or to pull together what's going on. Mm-hmm. So what's the next part to this for you? What yeah. are you hoping for next? Continue mm-hmm. in academia or to go back in and help make sure it all gets yeah. changed?
I do think that the academic space has been really great for me. I successfully got funding to do a postdoc.
Fantastic. So congratulations.
I can't speak to exactly what that research will be quite yet, but I do strongly believe in making sure that all my work is community-based. Right. I really would like to contribute and give back to people that are interested in doing similar work. So mentoring other folks that are interested in contributing to these conversations, I really That's hope that right. I'll be able to do that. I am currently working, like I said, with a group out of Rexdale that are developing a social supermarket. So we're moving into a pilot stage and we're experimenting with this kind of project. So I'm looking at what are some other community assets. Leaders on a community level are trying to address the issues that they're experiencing with the resources and the assets and the infrastructure that they have. So I want to profile that work and to try Brilliant. And support community organizations to be able to like leverage academic spaces to get support and resources and to bring attention to the hard work that they're doing. So that's where I'm at right now. I'm really not sure where it will lead, but it turns out that community organizations love research. So I'm happy to be there.
Well, because it's already been proven that until they get that research, people may not listen.
So. Right, exactly. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And this is a problem that isn't going away anytime soon, mm-hmm. unfortunately. So maybe it needs people like yourself to keep putting that fight in there and finding other ways and chatting to both sides, to be perfectly honest, really. Yeah. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. everyone's got to come. So, Janelle, that's awesome. You know, whether it's here in Canada or somewhere else in the world, it's something that we need to do more with. So, Janelle, thanks for coming on the show. Really do appreciate it.
Thank
Say
you,
hi
Claire.
To everyone at TMU.
Thank you.
And wish you all the best of luck.
Thanks, Claire.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Grad Chat. You can support CFRC by donating during our annual funding drive. Can you support us today? Yes, you can. Visit cfrc.ca today and give to Queen's Now to get a tax receipt for your donation to CFRC through Queen's University
or get donate securely to our website and get amazing free CFRC gifts and chances to win raffle prizes from local businesses. For every $5 donated, you get one raffle ticket and lots of CFRC swag.
Sego.
Buju Anim.
Danach A. At Anzenu Shukwithan.
Tante.
Hey, Inu Halikai.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Hi, I'm Christine Genier. Welcome to Words and Culture, the Athabascan episodes. Shan Shaklin Ayenji Danke, Akanzenu Shokwithan. Athabascan is the name given to the Dene languages on Turtle Island. You will hear these languages from Alaska through the Yukon, Northwest Territories, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Alberta, Manitoba, and then a jump down into Navajo country. It is a categorization given by anthropologists and linguists. There are many different dialects within each language group, and then even sub-dialects or regional dialects within the major ones. Our dialects tell those who hear the language where we are from and who we are from. Nowadays, it can tell them who you are learning from. Just a certain inflection or the addition of a consonant or vowel in a word can place you. And while we have different languages within the Athabascan group, those languages have common or root words. For instance, sho, cho, shro, some variation thereof, I have found often means big or good or grand, maybe old. It depends on the context of the word. Even the word dene, dena, dan, have a very common sound, and it all means people. In the Yukon, 7 of the 8 Indigenous languages are categorized as Athabascan. In this episode, we talk about Gwich'in language, or Dinji-Ju-Ginjik. Dinji-Ju-Ginjik is spoken in Alaska, Yukon, and Northwest Territories. This episode will include a short conversation that I had with my dear friend Bobby Rose Cooey about adventure tourism and her business, Dinji-Ju Adventures. First, Brandon Kikievichik is from Old Crow, Yukon. Brandon works in Gwich'in language recovery. I got to know Brandon as part of a working group building curriculum around Indigenous language transfer with the Yukon Native Language Center. Now, when we talk about language recovery work, that is to say we are helping each other remember. This language is with us. It is within us. We heard it around us, and it was spoken to us. To work in language recovery is to recover the language within, but also for the public space and the world around us. It is to hear it reflected in popular culture and education, at work and at home. I really enjoy speaking with Brandon about language work. He is generous with his teachings and doesn't concern himself a lot with what doesn't serve that work. He is intricate in his description of language in general, not just Indigenous languages, and he tells a really good story. A warning before we move ahead, this episode discusses suicide and residential school abuse.
My name is Brandon in English. My last name is a Gwich'in name. It comes from my great-grandfather, Kikavichik. It means, may I carry the arrow. And then my first mentor, he gave me the name of Dinjivikwichie, which is it's kind of a joke, but it means that even like easy or simple things come hard to me. But he named me the opposite, though. What he means by it is that everything comes easy to me. And that's like supposedly like a normal way of naming people sometimes. Back in the old days, you name them the opposite of what they are. I guess it's sort of like how you, like nowadays you would call a big guy tiny sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like that, I guess.
Where is home for you? Where are you from?
Old Crow, but the proper name for it is Techik. Techik just means the mouth of the river, because it's right at the mouth of the Crow River, which leads into Crow Flats. And Crow Flats is called Vantat, and we're called Vantat Gwich'in. So we take our name from from the Runtut is a wetland, and that river, the Crow River, which leads into Crow Flat, the mouth of that river is called Pei Chik, and that's the real name of Old Crow.
Is that where you grew up? Is that where your younger years took place?
Yep, grew up there, and then when I was 15, I was supposed to go to high school, but my dad died suddenly. He got sick, actually, and I spent like a month with him at the hospital in Yellowknife, and that was right around the time I was supposed to be going to high school. So I ended up not going to high school in grade 10, and I spent a year trapping with my grandfather out in the bush. And I knew that I could either go to school and learn from Oom Jits, or I could stay in Old Crow. And, you know, my grandfather was in his twilight years at the time. I could spend those years with him and learn from him. And that was what I was going to do. But my teachers in Old Crow were very harshly against that. And they really, really wanted me to continue my education because they saw potential in me, I guess. Mm-hmm. And they convinced me to go to school. So when I was 16, I came out here for school and then went to college and did all that stuff too. So
did you always have that Dunk-A-Koshe on your tongue? Was it always there?
I think so. I was always top of the class in Gwich'in class in school. We had like Gwich'in class in school. I was always top of that class. My grandfather always spoke to us in our dialect. And so at first I could only hear our dialect. I couldn't hear anyone else's dialect. Now I could hear any dialect now, but at the time I could only hear ours. But I think the fact that I could only hear our dialect actually proves that I must have had some of it in me already or something. Because what would happen would be, like, when I first started working, we started with a blank Word document, a 1960s tape recorder, and my elder. And then we just put the tape in of elders telling stories in Gwich'in, and we wrote it out in the Gwich'in language. And so when we were doing that at first, the first tape we put in, I was utterly surprised. I could not hear what she was saying at all. And I was so surprised because I was working with Joel before that. Anytime there would be something going on with the kids at school or something like that, it would be me and Joel. Like, there was one time when they made movies in the language, and so me and Joel helped them write their scripts. Mm-hmm. And so we worked together. So when Joel spoke the language to me, he's my grandfather's nephew, so he speaks the same dialect, so I could hear it perfectly. And then I was utterly surprised. I put the tape in and I couldn't hear what she was saying. And it turned out she was speaking a different dialect. So what Joel had to do is I would put the tape in, I would press play. He'd sort of hold his hand over the tape recorder like this. And he'd like look up into the air and he'd absorb the words. And then he'd wave his hand around when he wanted me to push stop. And then I'd push stop. And then he would say it in our dialect, and then I would hear it, and I'd be able to write it. And so I think that shows that I must have had it like in me already or something, because I wouldn't have been able to hear our dialect, and there wouldn't have been that discrepancy between another person's dialect and our dialect. I should have not been able to hear anything. I should not have been able to hear my dialect or the other dialect. But for some reason, I could only hear our dialect, so it must have been, I think probably because the language was spoken around my mother, and my mother was fluent too, while she was pregnant with me, mm-hmm. might have had something to do with it. So, you know, pregnant mothers out there, if you want your kids to learn your language, try to make sure it's spoken while you're pregnant, because I think there's a chance they might be hearing it.
Uh-huh, yeah. So you're talking about Joel. This is your grandfather's nephew.
Yeah.
And he was helping you. He was helping you do this language recovery work.
Yeah, at first he was, yeah. And then he passed away tragically, taking his boat out of the river. I just happened to be there at the time too, and you know, he didn't exactly die right in front of me, but you know, he was laying there on the road after the accident right in front of me, and then he got medevaced out and he passed away in Vancouver. And I was still a drug addict at the time, and I took it pretty hard, and it was 3 months after my nephew committed suicide too, my nephew who I got out of the group home and was, you know, trying to raise on my own. He committed suicide, then Joel passed away, so it was a rough time for me, and I went deep into the drugs and the alcohol. And then Marion, she told that story to our group the other day, how she saw what I was going through and how hard I was taking it. Mm-hmm. And that's when she approached me and she said, you know, I see how hard you're taking Joel's death, and, you know, if you want to keep working with the language, I can help you, she said. Mm-hmm. And that's when me and her started working together. And then pretty soon my Uncle Irwin, he got on because Marion and I were having extreme difficulty translating the old language. The reason why I worked with Joel is because Joel got held back from residential school. And so while he would have been in residential school learning from Aung Jits, instead, he was living with my great-grandparents, his grandparents, and he was living with them, traveling the land with them, absorbing their stories through the sparkle in his eyes. Yeah. And for that reason, he was able to understand that old language. And so when me and Marion started, we were having extreme difficulty understanding that old language. So we had to bring Irwin in, because Irwin, although he had to go to the non-status school because his dad was, I don't want to talk too much about that, but he went to the non-status school but when he got back, he was raised by my great-grandfather's oldest sister, who was born approximately sometime in the 1870s or whatever, out in the bush at a caribou fence village. And she was raised at that caribou fence village in her formative years and never saw a white person until she was in her late teens. And so Irwin knew that old language. So eventually Irwin came on with us to help us so that we could translate that old language. Caribou fences were cooperative efforts by our people, and they cooperated together, and they built what I would refer to as corrals. They're sometimes referred to as corrals. Mm-hmm. They're built out of wood. And where we are at the time, we were a little above the tree line. Where the caribou fences are above the tree line a little. And so a lot of that wood was imported. So they dragged that wood cross country to build those caribou fences where they built them. They're usually anywhere from 3 kilometers long to 8 kilometers long, and I've heard of some as long as 17 kilometers. And they were used to guide the caribou into giant traps. What they would do is he explained it really good in that story that I read yesterday. That was the story that I read yesterday. That was a man who was raised with his grandfather, and his grandfather was raised at a caribou fence too. His grandfather was orphaned, and this guy who ran the caribou fence, he took in orphans for his workforce. And that's how his grandfather ended up working on a caribou fence, so that's why he knew so much about it. And he explained it really good. You know, they wait in those valleys, those big valleys are called Unkitchungoe. We heard those Unkitchungoe are big, long valleys, and they have lots of feeder creeks that run into them, and they're up in the mountains. Mm-hmm. Those are good hunting areas. Long ago, the leader would develop the plan, and then they'll walk through that valley for miles, and he sends people up the most important creeks, hunters, and they go up all the creeks all the way up that valley, and they hunt as much caribou and moose as they can get. For that's preparing for winter. And so those valleys like that, there's caribou trails going through those valleys. That's where they built those caribou fences. Mm-hmm. And they would, when the caribou, they wait in that big valley, and when they seek, they have watchers on high peaks. When they see the caribou coming, there's a, like the way Alfred was explaining it, that there must be like a certain point they don't want them to get past. Because if they get beyond that point, you're not going to be able to flush them into the area you want to flush them into. So what you have to do is get there ahead of them and intercept them. And then once you intercept them, then you flush them into the area that you want them to go into. Mm-hmm. And once they get into that area, that's when they're going to hit that center fence. And that center fence is going to lead them right into the pocket of the trap. And that pocket of the caribou fence is where the snares are set. There's snares made of animal fur. People who don't know what snares are, I guess you could call it a noose, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like a noose, and it's like made of babiche. It's made of caribou skin. Caribou go in there and they get caught in the snares, and then they kill them with spears. And then they drag them out of the caribou fence really quickly, and they drag them to a butchering shack. And then everything is cleaned up good right away too. They don't let the blood stay there for very long. They clean it all up good right away.
So if you want to find out more about that, people are going to have to come and know how to ask for that knowledge too. Where you're from and where I'm from, they call this territory now Yukon Territory. Where I'm from, they got that big highway just landed right on us, right? The Alaska Highway. Where you're from, people still have to have an airplane or a boat, or a, not a boat, that's I'm thinking maybe Juno now, yeah, airplane, boat from other,
We go to other communities, yeah.
Oh, that's, yes, you do. You go Fort Yukon, So boat or airplane or other ways to get there, but not a highway, not for a car. Do you think, Brendan, that that has helped keep your way in your language?
I think the isolation definitely helped, for sure, no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But we're in a fairly dire situation too when it comes to the language. We're, you know, we're we may be a little ahead of some other communities, but not that far ahead. Mm-hmm. And we're still in a pretty scary place, but there's lots of good stuff going on there. There's a girl, a woman up there, Sophie Flather, who's doing amazing stuff. Her son speaks Gwich'in just as good as Dingy Zhukyu. Her son speaks Dingy Zhukyu just as well as he speaks English. Mm-hmm. And the things that they're doing with like immersion and language nests and stuff like that, it seems to be making a big difference, because, you know, even the elders are telling me they're starting to see kids speak the language around town and stuff like that, which is really nice to see. Mm-hmm. So I think definitely the isolation definitely like kind of benefited us in that sense. But we're in a pretty tough spot too.
Some of the tough spots, those challenges, do you think, how were you impacted by other societies coming up there and saying, okay, now you have borders, right? So if you look on a map, those maps they made for us now, we have the Yukon, and then next door we've got NWT, and we got Gwich'in there, but then there's that border there now. And on the other side, we got even not just a different territory, but now they've got a whole different country on that side. What did that do to the community?
This is a very, very heavy subject you're talking about here. We have a very long history with it. It's kind of hard to talk about.
Okay.
There were conspiracies, epidemics, relocation, manipulation of my people, racism, all of that stuff. It all happened. They completely severed one of the most powerful structures that we have in our culture, which is our familial structure. And there was absolutely no borders or nothing like that. And we had people who are from now modern day Alaska running caribou fences in our traditional territory. And their families are now Vantat today, and that was the norm back then. We all just worked and shared together, and you could live in any country you want, and you're going to have relatives there too. There was nothing like what we have today, so I thank you for bringing that up, Masih Cho, and I'm glad to be able to speak on it. But that is a very heavy subject, and that is a very... I mean, I'm probably going to write a book on that subject, actually. So that would be a very long conversation.
I'm going to ask you if you could let one... What, if you ever felt like, I just want the rest of the world to know one thing about this language up here, what do you know what that might be?
If I were to compare it to, like, say, English, for instance. Mm-hmm. So when you're... trying to communicate something, you're trying to paint pictures in people's minds, or you're trying to put a picture in a person's mind when you're trying to communicate something. In English, you'd imagine that we're creating that picture in the person's mind using puzzle pieces, because English is an analytic language. So you can put it all together with puzzle pieces, then you can take it all apart, you can analyze it, put it into these rigid structures and all that. That's analytic. Our language, being polysynthetic, would be when we're putting pictures in people's minds, when we're communicating, it's more like brush strokes, and it's more like painting a picture than it is puzzle pieces and analytical. It's on the opposite side of the spectrum, which makes it a little more difficult to learn, but it also gives it a sense of beauty that you might not find in analytic languages.
Do you feel okay sharing, teaching me one phrase in your way?
Wow, I wouldn't know what to choose. This is not like a beautiful word or poetic or anything like that, but it's a word I like to share. Dalcia.
Dalcia.
Yeah. So dalcia, two syllables, right? Two, dalcia, right? I want to make it for myself.
Oh.
Seven words in English in two syllables. Right, the ta is the benefactive, for the benefit of oneself. The L is the L classifier, that means I'm doing it. Xia would be in the future mode. But you're not talking in the future mode, you're talking in the optative. I want it, or I may, or whatever, let's, right? That's the optative. So instead of pronouncing that xia, you cut it off, that elongated vowel, you cut it off with a glottal, and it becomes tia, and that gives you your optative. Uh-huh. So in one word, you've got the benefactive, the L classifier, and the optative. Two syllables, seven words in English. That's why I like to share that one. It shows how different our language is.
Hey, it is so Nathan. Thank you for talking to us today, Brendan.
Yeah, merci, Joe.
That was Brendan Kiakevichik talking about language work and Gwich'in living, including... oh, the technology required to survive millennia. Millennia on top of millennia. In the most rugged environment this planet has to offer. Thank you, Brendan, for that great talk. I ran into my friend Bobby Rose Cooey the other day. We were both enjoying the spring weather after a long, dark winter. Bobby Rose is Tetlik Gwich'in from Fort McPherson, Northwest Territories. She is the owner-operator of Dingi Zhu, an adventure tourism business which provides a land-based experience on the river immersed in language and culture. I asked Bobby Rose, how's business?
Dri Bobby Rose, Kui Village, Tetlik Gwich'in, Ifle Tetledje, Gwijet, Hyper Zukan Gwitia, Tsutsukat, Rosemary Kui, Transit. Dorothy Alexi, Tsitsik had Abraham Kuth Sr. Chansut, Drin Gwinsu. Good afternoon, my name is Bobby Rose Kui. I'm Tetlet Gwich'in, main and people of the headwaters. I was raised in Fort McPherson, Northwest Territories, but I reside here on the Tahn in Kualantan, traditional territory. I own a adventure guide company called Dinjeju Adventures. Well, we offer river trips throughout the north. My first 5 years, running Dinjeju Adventures, I'm hosting river trips for northern communities. When I'm not doing that, I'm offering trips to guests who are coming into the territory.
What goes on these adventure trips?
Usually most of the trips I like to host and guide are multi-day river trips in remote areas like the Peel Watershed. On a daily basis, those trips look like waking up early to a cup of coffee on one of the banks of the Northern Rivers. Wake up to coffee and breakfast made by us, and we'll gather together, share breakfast among the mountains and by the river, by our friends. And once we're done breakfast, we'll start our journey on the river for a few hours, paddling down these beautiful rivers, and then we'll find a really beautiful lunch spot with beautiful views. Usually where we'll have time to gather everybody and share some stories about those areas. After lunch, we'll continue on to finding our camp spot for the night, where we'll get set up and cook a beautiful supper, set up our tents, enjoy the evening, and learn more about each other, but also learn more about the places that we're in. A lot of Indigenous peoples have been traveling on water or by water or near water for thousands and thousands of years. And over the last 50 to 60 years, more in these remote areas, we're seeing less of our people travel. And for me to go back to these places where like my grandfather traveled, or my grandparents and their grandparents before them, it's pretty magical. And it makes me wonder about how they lived and how they traveled, and, you know, being able to share the same words of the names of mountains and be able to share those stories as well is like something that makes me who I am and makes me stronger as a Gwich'in person.
Do you include a lot of language work?
Yeah, it's usually, it's really important to include language. And, you know, there might not be another Gwich'in person on the river, but I make sure that I'm using it daily, like I use it today and like every other day. But it's also important for me to learn language from other people who are out on the river, because I feel like I get to know people more personally once I know and understand how they speak and how they share their love. And when you speak the language, it's kind of a form of love.
What a beautiful way to describe it. It's a form of love. Dank e koshe is a form of love. Where can someone look for more information about your business?
I have social media along with the website. You could find a lot of information on Google. You could hear more of my stories that have been recorded on other places online as well. Right from when I started to recently. There's stories on my website from youth who've been on trips. I think the best way to learn more about these trips is to come on them.
That was Bobby Rose Cooey talking about her business, Dinjeju. To find out more, go to her website at dinjeju.com, dinjeizhuh.com. I'm Christine Genier. Soko Seni Denet A. Take good care out there.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin.
Soko Seni Denit E. Ninen Yuji Hina.
Ekose,